I don't know of anybody that she did not hate for one reason or another. But just why, I do not know. And feeling the way she did, she not only made herself very unhappy, she made everybody around her unhappy because of her disposition. But finally, it got so bad that even she left, or John ran her away. I don't know which is right, or rather which is correct. I don't know where she went, or what she did. But she, so far as I know, never came back to John's home.
The other case is a little bit involved. Aunt Sarah married Robert L. Hickerson. I knew Uncle Bob, and I knew his brother, T. Felix Hickerson, very well. Those two were as different as night and day. T. Felix was a perfect old maid, but awfully nice. But Uncle Bob, I just can't say the same thing about him at all. I know he was the husband of my aunt, and I tried awful hard in the beginning to understand and like him. But I found that he was completely devoid of any capabilities at being responsible for anything. That is putting it mildly, because everywhere he went, he left a definite trail of hardship for other people. About 1920, Dad engineered the sale of the timber from the lands making up the Lenore Plantation, which belonged to, as I have said, to Mother and Allie and Aunt Sarah. As it happened, finally, Aunt Sarah got a fortune out of that timber. Mother's part went for what we used to call boarding school. And, as I recall, I figured one time that Dad gathered together enough from the place, timber, raising cattle and so forth, to pay for some 45 years of what we used to call boarding school. Uncle Bob wheedled his way through Aunt Sarah's portion, which was a fortune, and instead of paying for his children's education and his family's upkeep, so to speak, he imagined himself as a financier. And he got in thick with a bunch of sharp cotton mill operators. And you can imagine what happened there. They picked him just as clean as anything you've ever seen. Took every dollar he had, and every dollar Aunt Sarah's had. As it developed, Allie was living with Uncle Bob and Aunt Sarah, and she took on the job of educating the children, or took on the job of playing for it. And Uncle Bob poor mouthed her about his situation until Uncle Bob got a hold of the rest of the money Allie had. From the timber, I mean. Of course, with whatever he could get out of Allie, he went back to see his cotton mill friends. And he got picked again. They took all the feathers. Uncle Bob wasn't satisfied with the havoc he'd already played. He had some more things in mind. And unbeknownst to everybody else, apparently, he pulled a deal that nobody yet can understand. He slipped into Waynesville, county seat of Haywood County, and by some means or other put a mortgage on Aunt Sarah's property that would break anybody's back, and agreed to pay a rate of interest that was out of this world. Of course, he couldn't do anything but take that money that he got by those means, and he went back to see his cotton mill friends again. And guess what? They picked him again. When all this came to light, Aunt Sarah was in a pretty terrible situation. She was just about to lose all of the old Lenore inherited property because Uncle Bob couldn't meet any payments or anything. He went hog wild. So, when it all came to light, Dad and Allie decided that they could not let Aunt Sarah just be rendered penniless, so to speak. So they started out devising means of paying off this mortgage, paying the interest, paying Sarah's benefit, but not Uncle Bob's. And it involved a lot of money. My family, in other words, mother's family, suffered pretty substantially as a result of Uncle Bob's gyrations and the kindness that Dad and Annie felt towards Aunt Sarah. But lo and behold, we found out that Uncle Bob wasn't through yet. He had another ace up his sleeve. He turned around and sued our family for Allie's upkeep. It's true that Allie lived with Uncle Bob and Aunt Sarah in Rhonda for many years. But the upkeep was a different thing. She paid it and he didn't. But he entered suit anyway. And the legal advice we got was, you better pay it. Because you cannot prove that he didn't provide Alice upkeep. That amounted to many thousands of dollars over so many years. But on the legal advice, we paid it. And I've never forgiven myself for agreeing to pay it in spite of what the lawyer said. I would have fought it until something froze over. I'd probably lost, but that just floored me and everybody else in the family. Every time I think about this whole situation, the back of my neck gets real hot and the hair stands on end and I feel like I'm ready to explode. But I guess looking at it in cold, hard light, it might have been much worse if we had tried to fight Uncle Bob's suit and wound up paying a lot more money into the bottomless pit. The best I can figure, Uncle Bob squandered three fortunes. Or enough money to be called that in those days. And in addition, the money that he got out of the lawsuit against us. And every time this whole subject occurs to me, I cannot help but feel pretty vicious about the whole thing. Because we did without a lot of things, all because of him, and I don't appreciate it. But as fate would have it, I hadn't heard the last. It so happens that Uncle Bob and Aunt Sarah had three children. Elizabeth, who was a very nice gal, beautiful. She won beauty contest at St. Mary's. Charles was just as mean as any copperhead you've ever run into in the weeds. Tom Weaver was the youngest, and he turned out fairly well. But that crowd used to spend a lot of time at the lodge. And it was impossible to keep peace, or for me to keep peace with Charles. We stayed in some sort of a ruckus most of the time. And he was the kind of rat that would scratch and bite, and of course I wasn't taught to fight that way. And I stayed marked up most of the time. We weren't very old at the time. This was before all the shenanigans about the money. But I was playing in the doghouse, no less. And Charles insisted on getting in the doghouse too. And he started some of his tactics. And I figured out how to take care of him. I got my foot right under his chin on his Adam's apple, and I started pushing against the wall. And he turned blue. And I told him if he ever scratched or bit me again, I was going to kill him. And I meant it, I guess. I don't know. But he was just naturally mean. He didn't want to get along with anybody. And he didn't. And he turned out to be a regular bum. And thereby hangs the tale. I was sitting in the living room there in Atlanta years and years and years later. Phone rang. And it was the social services people of Georgia. They told me that they had my cousin in jail and that they were going to parole him to me and that I would be responsible for him. And you can imagine what happened then. When they got through listening to me, they never called me again. I told them a few things like threatening to do away with him and everything else. And if they might be able to parole him to me, but he wouldn't last very long. So they backed off. That's the last I heard. I don't know what happened after that. But that's part of the black sheep deal. I probably shouldn't have said as much as I have. But you can't help but express yourself when you get just so full of disgust and all of the other a wasteful life at the family's expense. He was smart, no doubt about it. Uncle Bob was. But he was all bad smart. Anyway, you see, I don't claim that everybody that I mentioned was Lily White. This punctuation between chapters comes from the strip in the funny paper known years ago as the Katzenjammers. And I guess it's pretty appropriate to quote Ms. Katzenjammer. I don't remember exactly what she was so rolled up about, but in one of the strips many, many years ago, she said, enough of a thing is enough, and too much is just a plenty. That seems rather appropriate after discussing the black sheep. Chapter 4, The Michaels. My notes are more plentiful concerning three main branches of the relationship, namely the Michaels, the McDowells, and the Lenores. And I would like to make a few remarks about each, and then I would like to show how other names, family names, weave into the picture of the family relationship. But for the moment, we'll talk about the Michaels. They were French Huguenots, and back there somewhere, they took refuge in the Duchy of Cleve in the 17th century. My notes show that at least some of them came over to Pennsylvania before 1700. That is, they came from France to the New World in the 17th century. And just at that point, the phone rings, and I guess I've got the telephone recorded. My notes show that some of these people came from the old world, so to speak, to Pennsylvania. Before 1700. they also show that the French pronunciation of the name was finally given up, and that the name was Anglicanized, however you pronounce that. But the spelling was maintained. This argues with members of the family that seem to think that at one time the name was spelled M-I-C-H-E-L. I might add here that I started negotiations with Jack Petit, who lives in France and does genealogical research. I got his name and address from Nora Lenore, who lives in Switzerland and who attended the Lenore reunion up at Lenore in 1987. It didn't take me long to find out, though, that this fella could vision a lot of fat checks in terms of thousands of dollars, and so I broke off negotiations with him pretty promptly. He wanted all the money and no work because he wanted to know what ship an individual came over on, when it docked, their name, and all about it. He wouldn't have to do anything but just rewrite it, practically. So I decided that wasn't worthwhile to follow him any further. I don't think our pocketbook was big enough to deal with that type of individual that far away. At any rate, Henri Philippe Michel, born in 1727, married Constantia Brittman in Philadelphia. His father, Henri Michel, born in 1695, married Eugenia Galantier, daughter of Philippe Galantier. It is not clear whether any of these people came from France or were born in the Pennsylvania area. Henri Philippe Michel's son, Conrad, was born in 1761. Conrad married Sarah Hope, and they had a son, Jacob, in 1792. Conrad, after a rather short marriage, passed away, and Sarah Hope Michel, with her young son, moved to Lincolnton, North Carolina, so that she might be with her brothers. Jacob grew up in Lincolnton, became prosperous in business, and in 1815 married Catherine E. Ramseur. There's several ways to spell that name, and we get into that a little bit later. Of that marriage, George W. Michel, my grandfather, was born October the 7th, 1825. Later, Jacob sent George to the University of Pennsylvania, where he graduated with honors in medicine in 1847. Dr. George W. Michael set up a practice in Marion, North Carolina, where he eventually married Mary Carson. Later on, she and their two children passed away due, I believe, to diphtheria. They are buried in the Buck Creek section near Marion. Having moved his practice from Marion to Rutherfordton, Dr. George married his second wife, Martha M. McDowell, in June 1861. Dr. George was a delegate to the special convention in Raleigh, North Carolina, which met for the purpose of deciding what action North Carolina should take about secession. He served as a surgeon in the 16th North Carolina Regiment during the war between the states, and married Martha McDowell Michael in June 1861. They had issue as follows. Mary Moffat Michael, known as Sister, was born March the 29th, 1862, died December the 24th, 1941. She never did marry. John McDowell Michael, my father, born December the 23rd, 1863, died January the 28th, 1928, having married on October the 17th, 1889, Mary Lenore, my mother, who in turn was born September the 15th, 1865, and died December 30th, 1940. That is the substance of my notes on the Michaels, except what I previously discussed as the immediate family. It's a sort of a shorthand version, but maybe I didn't listen close enough. This boy and girl started going together when they were in high school and finally fell in love and decided they'd get married. Oh, I noticed one thing, though, and that was that the gal always had a black ribbon tied around her neck. So one day he asked her, why do you always have a black ribbon tied around your neck? And she said, well, someday I'll tell you. But you'll have to be satisfied with that answer. And he says, all right. So they got married. Years and years later, came up around the 25th anniversary or something like that. And He said, "You know, before we got married, I asked you why you had that black ribbon tied around your neck." She said, "Yeah." He said, "You promised to tell me sometime." And she said, "Do you want to know now?" And he said, "Yes, I want to know now." So she reached up and untied the ribbon around her neck, and her head fell off. I agree with you, that's pretty bad. Chapter 5, the Lenores. The history of the Lenore family, so far as I know it, goes back to Brittany, along the coast of France, and the seaport of Nantes. Many of the early members of the family were fishermen and mariners. That might be a polite word for pirates, for all I know, but I don't think it was. But during the Reformation, some of the Lenores embraced the new Protestant faith and became Huguenots. During the religious troubles of the late 17th century, a great many Huguenots were driven out of France and sought refuge in the Protestant nations of Europe, especially Switzerland, the Netherlands, in England. The English colonies of America were part of that refuge territory. It is believed that Isaac Lenore, who came to New York via Switzerland in 1696, is also believed that Isaac Lenore after following the tendencies of some of his seafaring ancestry, wound up in Virginia and that he was the father of Thomas Lenore, who married Mourning Crosley and settled in 1761 on the Tar River in Edgecombe County, North Carolina. Thomas died in 1765 and was survived by his wife and 10 children. As best we can piece the story together, there were four daughters. Anne married Robert Westmoreland and settled in Spartanburg County, South Carolina. Betty married John Latimer and settled in the Hancock County, Georgia. Leah married Robert Whitaker and settled in Franklin County, North Carolina. Mary married William Perry and settled in Western North Carolina. Of the six sons, one died unmarried. Robert settled in Brunswick County, Virginia. Thomas Jr., Isaac, and John settled on the Wateree River below Camden, South Carolina. William settled in North Carolina and became known as General William Lenore of Happy Valley fame. General William Lenore was a delegate to the Hillsborough Convention, which convened in 1775 to arrange a government for North Carolina after the royal governor fled. He served with the commission of captain during the American Revolutionary War and was later commissioned general of the militia. He was a member of the first board of trustees of the University of North Carolina. Lenore County was named for him. General William married Ann Ballard in 1771 and was responsible for the building of Fort Defiance for protection from the Indians and to serve as a residence in Happy Valley as it stands restored today. They had 9 children. Six daughters and 3 sons. The second son, known as Colonel Thomas Lenore, married